Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, the end of another summer of minor league baseball is fast approaching. Once Labor Day happens, that's usually the end of the season. Today we go back to an age when a town or city of any size had a minor league baseball team, the 1940s and 50s. Forgotten teams like the Ponca City Dodgers, the Muskogee Giants, the Bartlesville Pirates, or the Elk City Elks. In fact, that last team lives on in memory thanks to one prodigious home run hitter, a guy who pumped gas by day and pounded out homers by night, Joe Bauman, who hit 72 homers in Roswell, New Mexico in 1954. That was the professional baseball record until Barry Bonds hit 73 in 2001 and still stands as the minor league record. Former sports writer and minor league historian Galen White writes about Bauman and some of the other legends of the minor leagues in his book Left on Base in the Bush Leagues. In a day when there were only 16 major league teams and none west of St. Louis, there was plenty of major league talent in the minor leagues. For some, they had a fatal flaw. They may be a great hitter, but a lousy fielder, or vice versa. A strikeout pitcher, but with dubious control of the strike zone. Or players with battles with alcohol. Still others, with the major league minimum salary at $5,000, found they could make more money as a star in the minor leagues than a journeyman in the major leagues back east. Others simply preferred small town life. Galen White writes about great players and great teams back in the golden age of baseball in his new book. This book, Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, as you write in the introduction, said this was a book that was sort of formulating for a long time, back to the 1970s, when you were sitting in a Kansas City Royals dugout and hearing an old-time major leaguer talk about his first days in the minor leagues when he witnessed three no-hitters like within the first 2 weeks of his baseball career.
The player was Harry Dunlop. He was the coach for the Kansas City Royals at the time. When he caught those three no-hitters, he was 18 years old, and he thought to himself, this is going to be a piece of cake. But Harry and I became good friends. I had started my career as a sports writer, in fact, had worked for the Oklahoma Journal at one point, wound up in the corporate world working for Hallmark Cards was my first gig. And I did some freelancing. I was out at Royal Stadium, and I happened to mention to Harry this idea I had of writing a book on minor league greats who either never made it to the majors, or if they did, they flopped or didn't last long. And so Harry was intrigued by that. The manager of the Royals at the time, Jack McKeon, got involved in the conversation. So out of that came a list of players that I wound up bird-dogging across the country and interviewing for this book, Left on Base in the Bush Leagues.
Why did it take you so long to finally get the book out? Was it just other things intervened, or what exactly?
Life. I started work, it's interesting, I started work on this project on a Smith Corona electric typewriter, to give you some idea. And my kids can remember me wadding up paper, throwing it in the trash can, and saying things somewhat like the father in the Christmas story. In the corporate world, I wound up becoming a speechwriter for different CEOs, and the higher I got up in the corporation, the less time I had to write. Now, I continued to do the research all during that period of time, and I never gave up. I just finally, when I retired, 2012, I started knocking off some books that I had done all the research on over the years. So the Left on Base book is the fourth one I've produced. The first one, the Bilko Athletic Club, and then another one, Singles and Smiles, about Artie Wilson and how he broke the color barrier in the Pacific Coast League. All those came out of that research in the 1970s. And this book, Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, is more national in that players are from all over the country, and there's several from Oklahoma.
Right. Now, the bigger story, I think, of Left on Base is sort of documenting this era of minor league baseball. You document the fact that in 1948, there were 52 minor leagues from Class D, C, B, A, AA, and AAA. And by the mid-60s, that was down to 18. And there's a great cover photograph on the book that shows just a few of the multitude of players in spring training for the loss of, at that point, probably the Brooklyn Dodgers, trying to make the club. And it's just like a sea of humanity of players reporting to spring training, hoping for that chance in the big leagues.
There's 515 players shown in that picture.
Wow.
They were at Dodger Town, and they were competing for, actually, major league jobs at that time. There were only 16 major league teams, 25 players to the roster, so that's 400 spots in the majors. And you had alone in that photograph 515 players, most of whom were going to wind up in the Dodgers' minor league farm system. You had the next year, 49 was the high point for the minors. There were 59 leagues, 463 towns with teams. I like to say that if a town had a bank, they probably had a team.
Wow.
And the most exciting thing in town was either a bank robbery or going to the ballpark at night. But it was a great event for these towns. Baseball was the kind of the community center. You didn't have, in 49, you didn't have air conditioning, you didn't have television. So those two things later would keep fans away from the ballpark. But at that time, the ballpark was where it was at, and that's where people went and socialized and really made baseball the national pastime. I like to say that baseball's nickname of national pastime is not because of the major leagues, it's because of the minors and what the situation was in the late 40s and early 50s. The majors, up until 1953, of the 16 teams, 11 of them were in five cities: Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and St. Louis. So it's quite regional in terms of the majors. And I also, with this book coming out and me visiting some of these small towns, I realized that pro baseball, these fans did not leave pro baseball. Pro baseball left them.
That's interesting. And really, the reason for the contraction of the minor leagues was basically Major League Baseball's decision, not the inability for small towns to support a minor league team?
Well, what eventually happened was all the minor league teams became affiliated with the major league teams. The exciting thing about the period in which I write about is that these were, in many cases, independent teams run by local people, and that gave them that local flavor and that sense of ownership. Fans, of course, could listen to Major League Baseball on the radio, and there was a game of the week on television, and eventually, of course, some of the major league teams started to televise their games into these areas. But these fans, and I was one of them growing up in Los Angeles before the Dodgers arrived, you would latch on to a player who played for your hometown team, and you would follow that player throughout his career. And the teams that he played for in the majors, inevitably those became the teams that you rooted for. So I grew up in Los Angeles, and before the Dodgers got out there, Los Angeles had two teams, the Los Angeles Angels and the Hollywood Stars. I latched on to Steve Bilkel when he came to the Angels in 1955. I looked at him. This guy was 6'1". Weighed anywhere between 235 and 270 pounds. And he hit home runs like Babe Ruth, and I later found out he drank beer like Babe Ruth. So he was my hero.
And this is something that's really interesting. You know, you write that the Pacific Coast League, which was the league that the Hollywood Stars and the Los Angeles Angels were in, the San Francisco Seals, that was like a West Coast major league at the time.
Well, they called themselves at the third major league, and it was an open classification in the latter years. That's right before the majors came to the West Coast. It was more first class in many ways than the majors. They traveled by air long before the major leagues did. Of course, the cities in the Pacific Coast League, the climate was much milder. The veteran players preferred playing on the West Coast, and in many cases, they made more money in the Coast League than they did in the majors, because most of the players in the majors made the minimum at that time, and that was anywhere between $5,000 and $7,000, depending on the year. And players like who I write extensively about in the book, Joe Bauman from Welch, Oklahoma, near Mickey Mantle's hometown of Commerce. Joe Bauman grew up in Oklahoma City, and then he went on. He served during the war years. He served in Norman there at the Naval Air Base. Joe was a great hitter. He never made it to the majors. He didn't play any higher than Class AA, only had one at-bat. But he achieved stardom in two places, Elk City. He was a semi-pro star, played 3 years there, was known as the local Babe Ruth. And then after Elk City, he went on back to organized baseball. He had been in organized baseball in 1948. He was playing for Hartford in the Class A Eastern League. The Boston Braves owned his contract. They wanted to cut his salary by $200 a month. And Joe said he could make more money selling shoestrings in the street in Oklahoma City. So that's how he wound up in Elk City, became the Babe Ruth of semi-pro ball in western Oklahoma, went down to Artesia, New Mexico, led all the minors in home runs two straight years. And then the next year, he went to Roswell. That was 1954, and hit 72 to set an all-time record. And so during the day, by the way, Joe pumped gas at his Texaco service station. He had a Texaco service station on Route 66 there in Elk City. So he got another one in Roswell and, as I say, pumped gas during the day and pumped balls over the fence at night.
That's really interesting. And this was another interesting part of this book is that some of these players in the minor leagues, they looked at the odds of making it in the major league, looked at the money they were making in the minor leagues, especially some of these independent leagues where it was locally owned. They made their own deals. They were making just about as much as a minimum salaried player in the major leagues. And they said, why take that chance when I can be a star here in this local scene and make as much money as I would if I made it to the majors?
They were living in a small town, which they preferred. That was the case with Joe Bauman. He didn't like big cities any more than another player who I write about, Tom Jordan Sr. Tom Jordan Sr. Was born in the Lawton, Oklahoma area. He's lived most of his life in Roswell, New Mexico, where he had a ranch. He made it to the majors three different occasions, and in each case, he walked away from the majors to go back to his ranch in Roswell because he could make more money at his ranch than he could playing ball. Now, he continued playing in the minors. In fact, over 18 years, he had a .338 batting average. So he was a big star in the minors. By the way, Tom will turn 100 on September 5. He is the oldest living major league ball player.
Wow. So this was not uncommon for a player who was making a good salary during this particular time in the minor leagues, especially when they were not affiliated with every minor league club was affiliated with a major league club, for that player to just say, this is good enough.
Well, for example, there was a player named Forrest Frosty Kennedy. He had 60 home runs at Plainview, Texas in 1956. And he made more money in the minors. Plus, he said he was treated to dinner and drinks everywhere he played. And his quote is, I was a king in the minor leagues. Why go up to the majors to be just a spear carrier? So that was the attitude of a lot of these players. And also, if you were a home run hitter, there was another source of income, and that was called picking the fences. And that was a tradition throughout West Texas and Oklahoma and eastern New Mexico where a guy would hit a home run, and after hitting the home run, the fans would show their appreciation by sticking $1, $5, $10 bills through the screen. In the case of Joe Bauman, he hit three home runs on the last day of the season in 1954 to break the record, and fans stuck $800 in cash through the screen that day, and that amount of money then is worth $8,000 now. So to give you an idea of just how well these guys did if they were home run hitters.
My guest today is Galen White. He's a former sports writer for the Denver Post and Arizona Republic, and he's a baseball writer. This is his third book in the recent years about some of the old stories of the minor leagues, and this is titled Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. For a lot of these players, I think you quote Branch Rickey at the very beginning of the book, you know, there are great ball players, and even in the minor leagues, you take the best, he said, take the best college team versus a Class D team, a five-game series, the college team might come on top. If you have them play 100 games, the Class D team will just rip them apart. But the other thing he said was that it's such a near-miss thing to make the major leagues. And for great hitters, you know, you have to control the strike zone. If you don't control the strike zone, the pitcher will, you'll be unsuccessful. For how many of these players, how big an issue was that?
Well, if some of the I write about two pitchers, and one of them, that strike zone kept him out of the majors, yeah. And that was Steve Dalkowski. And his nickname was Whiff or Walk. And he was the inspiration for the character in the movie Nuke LaRouche.
Yeah, in Bull Durham, yeah.
So one season, Dalkowski, this was at Stockton, he walked 262, and he also struck out 262. So that'd give you so the strike zone, or the inability to get the ball in the strike zone, kept Dalkowski out of the majors. And that's unfortunate because most people think that he threw harder than any other person in history, including Nolan Ryan. Ron Netchai is another pitcher I write about. He had some control problems, but what he's best known for is striking out 27 in a nine-inning game.
That's everybody.
The only to do that, yes. Now, it was a no-hitter. It was not a perfect game. There was a pass ball. There was an error, and there was another grounder. So it wasn't a perfect game, but he jumped all the way from Class D to the Pittsburgh Pirates in the majors in 1952. He had a 1-6 record in the majors. He wound up, he had ulcers when he was in the majors, and then he was drafted into the Army, and the Army food aggravated that condition, and he was discharged, hurt his arm, and never pitched in the majors again. But Branch Rickey called him the greatest pitching prospect that he ever saw. And Joe Graziola, who caught Ron Netchai, said that if he hadn't hurt his arm, he would have been one of the all-time great pitchers. So it was just sometimes just a little thing that kept these guys out of the majors. And it did come down basically to the strike zone and whether or not a guy, a hitter, could hit the balls on the edge of the strike zone or whether or not a pitcher could get the ball into the strike zone.
Early in the book, there's another pitcher, Al Piero, who had a sidearm delivery, and he was about the same. He struck out tremendous numbers of players, but he also walked tremendous number of players and threw a tremendous number of wild pitches as well.
Yes, he was known as Wild Bill Piero. I believe he pitched in Ponca City. That's where he was, but he jumped all the way from Class D to the majors, also with the Pirates. Bill Piero, interesting enough, he pointed out he didn't like the word Bush League, and I can understand that. The term Bush League or Bushes or Busher came out of the writings of Ring Lardner early in the 1900s, and he was a famous writer, wrote this classic book called You Know Me, Al. It was a novel consisting of letters from a fictional Bush League pitcher named Jack Keefe, and he was writing to a friend back home in Indiana named Al Blanchard. And so he used these terms, Bushes, Busher, Bush Leagues throughout the book, and it caught on. And to this day, you know, the term Bush League, Busher, Bushes is still used widely beyond baseball literature.
Yeah.
But as Piero pointed out, you know, he thought it was demeaning, and I can understand that. In no way, though, am I trying in this book trying to put down anything that any of these ball players accomplished. Just to get into professional baseball was quite an accomplishment. And whatever level that you played at, whether it was at the lowest Class D or at the highest in open classification in the minors, it was quite an achievement to get there and then stay there.
But, of course, you know, the goal for a lot of these players was the major leagues, and that was elusive when there were only 16 teams and most of them on the East Coast, if you were in the West. There, a lot of times there was overlooked opportunities and also scouts who would look at, you know, today now everything's measured empirically. Moneyball is the big term for figuring out if a player has major league potential. Back then it was a scout taking a look at what they looked like. And there was, I think there's one story in the book about a player who was an incredible player, but he just didn't look like a major league player.
That's probably Al Pinkston you're talking about. And Al Pinkston was a black player. He had played in the Negro Leagues, and he got into organized baseball, and what nobody knew at the time, he had shaved 9 years off of his age. As one of his managers said, oh, well, he just forgot to have a few birthdays. But Al Pinkston played until age 48. He won 4 batting championships in the Mexican League. He won 2 more stateside to give him a total of 6, which ties him for most in minor league history. But Al Pinkston made it to Kansas City. He was at spring training with the Athletics in 1955. He played for a manager in the minors named Clyde Klutz, who not only was a fine manager but went on to become an outstanding scout. And Clyde did not think that Al Pinkston had what it would take to play in the majors. In large part, he had an unusually shaped body. He was 6'5", and most of it was long legs that looked like stilts. And he did have trouble in the outfield because of that physique. He had a hard time bending over and picking up a ball was one issue. But so he was not a good defensive player. But he was an outstanding hitter. And in today's age, he would be an outstanding designated hitter. as is the case with Joe Brovia, another player who broke in San Francisco at the age of 18, and in his first game he made three errors and had three hits and became tagged with the label of a good hit, no field. It took him, he finally made it to the majors with the Cincinnati Reds in 1955. He was 33 years old, so it took him 15 years to make it to the majors. And when he got there, all they would do was pinch hit him. So he batted 18 times, and then 37 days later, he was back in the minors.
Hmm. I was thinking of Bob Dillinger, actually, who did make it to the major leagues, I think with the St. Louis Browns. But, he didn't have that look of a major leaguer.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, Bob Dillinger wore what they referred to as Coke bottle glasses. And this was at a time where very few major leaguers wore glasses. And, in fact, even fewer played in the infield. And Bob played third base. He was an outstanding hitter in the majors. He over six seasons, he batted .306. He won three American League stolen base titles. And yet, he was accused of not hustling as much as everybody thought he should hustle. He was one of these guys who everything he did was quite natural to him. It didn't look like he was expending that much effort. But he was an outstanding player. He had a different kind of personality than the most players at that time. He was outspoken in that he did not like wearing what he called the baseball uniform, a monkey suit. That didn't go over very well. And he also didn't, as in his own words, give management the respect they thought they deserved. So as a result, even though he was a .306 lifetime hitter, Bob Dillinger wound up in the minor leagues in the Pacific Coast League playing for Sacramento, and he won the batting title his second year out there, still didn't get another shot in the majors. So in effect, Bob Dillinger was exiled to the minors.
Hmm. For other players that never got a chance in the major league, alcohol was a big story for some of those minor leaguers with big league talent, but alcohol held them back.
Joe Taylor comes to mind. In fact, the title is called Plain Drunk. Joe usually played with at least a shot or so inside of him of some drink. In fact, as some of his teammates said, it kept him lubricated. And also, I guess, lowered his fear of the curveball, helped him hang in there a little better. But the players who spoke to me about Joe, and I interviewed Joe myself on two different occasions, thought that he had the potential of being the Black Babe Ruth. He was that good of a hitter. So he was a hard hitter and a hard drinker. Branch Rickey, a teetotaler, was raved about Joe Taylor and how he could play with a snootful, as Branch Rickey said. But Branch Rickey knew better than to try to put him on one of his teams. So Joe Taylor did make it to the majors. He had cups of coffee, brief stays with the St. Louis Cardinals, the Baltimore Orioles, and the Cincinnati Reds. But it probably kept him out of Cooperstown because many of the players thought he was that good that he was Cooperstown material. Steve Dalkowski, who I mentioned earlier, he had an alcoholic father. He was an alcoholic himself at a very early age. He's still living today at age 80, but he's in an assisted living home with alcohol-induced dementia. So alcohol was part of his problem, not just his inability to get the ball over the plate.
You also write about another player in Little Rock at the Arkansas Travelers who kept a bottle stashed in center field. And some innings, if he knew he wasn't going to bat, he'd just hang out in center field.
That was Rosie Cantrell. And Rosie, one time, gotten in the previous night, he had four line drive hits, and the younger players on the team were just in awe of his ability to hit line drives while having a little bit of alcohol in him. So they asked him the next day at batting practice, you know, how do you do it? And he says, well, fellas, when you're up to play, you see just one ball. When I'm up there, I see four or five, and I pick out the one I like best.
But obviously it was a big problem for him, and it's one of those things that kept him in the minors.
Yes. Here again, too, though, Rosie Cantrell had other interests. He preferred Little Rock. Actually, he lived in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, for most of his career, and he just preferred the small towns. And the player said, Rosie, if you stop drinking today, you'd be in the majors tomorrow. And Rosie said, well, where do you go from there? So, you know, Rosie had it figured out that he was best off where he was, and that was in Arkansas. I was going to mention one other chapter in the book because it does pertain in a way to Oklahoma, and that would be the chapter about Pat Stacey, the manager in Big Spring, Texas. Who
Yes, the Big Spring Bronx. Yeah,
right. And he filled his team with Cubans. And Stacey, who was the player manager for the team, he was the only non-Cuban. And they became known as the Yankees of the lower minors. They won two pennants with the Cuban players, finished second three times, and third on another occasion. The use of Cubans in the minor leagues, Big Spring probably did the best job with it, but it was also widespread in the Sooner State League in Oklahoma. And Ardmore, as a matter of fact, had a number of Cuban players, as did some of the other teams in the league. The use of the Cuban players, what it did was it kept a lot of these teams, it helped them get by financially because these players would play for less money. But it also helped bring down the walls of segregation.
Yes.
Both Oklahoma and in Texas. While these Cubans initially were light-skinned, over time, some darker-skinned Cubans would come in to both states, and again, that helped ease the segregation or helped erase this barrier between black and white in those states.
Yeah, and of course, there's a couple of instances in the major leagues where black players basically adopted Hispanic surnames in order to play. They were not African-American, they were Cuban.
Right. And again, this was culturally very significant because in the case of Pat Stacey, he was the most successful manager in terms of using Cubans. And he brought close to 200 Cubans to the U.S. In turn, many of these Cubans stayed and brought their families from Cuba and escaping Castro. And one of his players, and I write about him in the book, Tito Arancibia. Tito brought 37 members from his own family from Cuba, got them out of there so they didn't have to live a life under Castro. So that happened more than one case. These players would come here, made the states their home, learn the language, and start a new life for themselves, all because they came here initially as baseball players.
It's hard to say if baseball would have had a different future if the minor leagues continued to proliferate like they did in the post-war era. But I was wondering, what do you think baseball lost by the fact that there was no Class D team in Ponca City or Ardmore or, you know, Class C team in Muskogee or something like that, in Oklahoma and all the states around the country? What did baseball lose by losing that extensive minor league system of baseball?
I just traveled in that area after the book came out. The book came out in May, and I launched the book in the places that I write about: Roswell, New Mexico, Big Spring, Texas, La Mesa, Texas, and Artesia, New Mexico. And I think what baseball has lost is that connection to their roots, and their roots are in these towns. When I pass through Elk City, Oklahoma, and I see on old Route 66, this ballpark called Ackley Park, built in 1939 as part of a WPA project. It's a Red Rock Park. It's beautiful. It's still there. It represents the roots of baseball, the roots of baseball in western Oklahoma. Now it's only used for high school and American Legion ball. But when I see things like that, and I see that most people don't even know what that ballpark represents, then I know that baseball has lost its connection to its roots.
Former sports writer and minor league historian Galen White speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.